All right, so let me see how far we want to go back. Let me just get a running start from Matthew chapter 18, and I'll read verses 7 through 14, and then that way we'll be good to go. Woe to the world because of its stumbling blocks, for it is inevitable that stumbling blocks come, but woe to the man or to that man through whom the stumbling block comes. If your hand or your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life crippled or lame than to have two hands or two feet and be cast into the eternal fire. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out and throw it from you. It is better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and be cast into the fiery hell. See that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I say to you that their angels in heaven continually see the face of my Father who is in heaven. For the Son of Man has come to save that which was lost. What do you think? If any man has 100 sheep, and one of them has gone astray, does he not leave the 99 on the mountains and go and search for the one that is straying? If it turns out that he finds it, truly I say to you that he rejoices over it more than over the 99 which have not gone astray. So it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones perish. All right, if you remember, just by way of quick summary, remember Jesus, when they asked his disciples about paying the temple tax, Jesus made the point that as the Son of God, I do not have to pay the tax for the temple of God. Yet he did it anyway so he would not offend the people collecting the tax and things like that. So Jesus did not exercise his right as the Son of God so that he wouldn't offend. And so that's the backdrop for this whole thing. And then remember, the disciples immediately after that came and said, who's going to be the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? In essence, asking, where am I going to rank in the kingdom of heaven? You know, this stuff is happening. It's going to be awesome. You apparently are the Messiah. So where does that leave me? And then Jesus calls the little child to be in the midst of them. And says, unless you are converted, that means someone else changes you. It has nothing to do with you. Someone else changes you. And you become like little children. You will not even enter into the kingdom of heaven. Okay, so they're worried about rank. Jesus says, you need not worry about that. You need to worry about being converted. And then once you're converted, you reckon that to be true, that you were converted, not by your own works. Because he says in verse 4, whoever then humbles himself as this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So a child is humble because the child standing in the middle of the group of the men knows he has nothing to offer those men, right? Okay, and then Jesus begins talking about the stumbling blocks. So this is all the same conversation. That's what I want to give the summary and the backdrop. This is all in the context of this conversation. It's about being humble and not exalting your right and your position at the expense of offending someone else. Okay? And then Jesus talks about the necessity. You know, God uses trials and struggles and pain and bad things in this world. But that still does not mean that the one through whom those bad things come is not accountable. You know, people are still accountable for their sins, still accountable for things like that. We talked about this the first week. Excuse me, not really last week. But the point that Jesus makes about your hand or foot causing you to stumble, cutting it off and throwing it from you, it's better to enter life crippled or lame than to have two hands and two feet and be cast into the fire. And if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out and throw it from you. It's better for you to enter life with one eye than to have two eyes and cast into the fire hell. Give me the point about that. In this context, because there's a little shift there in verse 7 when he says, it's inevitable that stumbling blocks come. Okay, they're going to come. We talked a little bit about Judas, right? Last week, mentioned him, how God chose him to betray the Son of God. But Judas was still accountable for what he did. Okay? So that's the vessel through which the stumbling block comes. But then he changes in verse 8. If your hand or foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. If your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. What do you think about that?
extreme.
Okay.
But I think it's more spiritual than it is actual physical. So it says temptations will come. So if temptations are inevitable, and yet you're supposed to gouge out your eye or cut off a limb, then everybody would walk around lame or blind.
Okay.
So I think it's more spiritual. And it's just saying, I think it's setting up the hierarchy or the importance of what everything is. So it's supposed to be the spiritual first and then the physical second.
Okay.
I also think it's talking about the severity of sin and how it is like a cancer. So don't let it spread. Deal with it immediately rather than it'll go away.
Yeah. So we don't want to spiritualize it too much. I agree. He's not saying pluck your eye out and cut your hand off. He's not saying that. Mm-hmm. But our spiritual struggles could manifest in physical things. There could be physical things that we need to get rid of that are causing us spiritually to stumble. Right? It's not just the invisible things. And, oh, I've got a bad attitude today. I need to cut that out. You know? So remember, this is a part of the same conversation. And so, when a person is converted, what do we call that in Christianese?
Conversion?
Yeah.
Justified?
And the point of salvation, saved? Yeah, okay. And so often people, when they talk about their spiritual walk and their spiritual situation, they say, oh, I know Jesus because I was saved when I was 12 years old and I walked the aisle and I did this and I blah, 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 did that. And then, I mean, that's it. Like, that's what they talk about. But it seems here, we didn't read it, but we've read it previous weeks. In verses 3 and 4, it's like Jesus is hinging his whole conversation about the stumbling and everything on this point. When you are converted, humble yourself. Like, when you understand that you have been saved by no works of your own, and you don't deserve to be here, you have not earned the right to be in the kingdom of God, much less choose your rank. You need to reckon that to be true and humble yourself. Understand where you are in the kingdom. And then as you're doing that, you're walking this Christian walk. There are going to be struggles. There are going to be stumbling blocks. You're going to have to wrestle with. Stumbling blocks are not fun. You ever stumbled over something? Stubbed your toe? Fell? Walk around in the dark? Whatever. It hurts. It's inconvenient. Your adrenaline spikes. All those things are going to happen. But you as a believer, this is what he's saying, because Jesus is talking about believers here, right? As he says, he's talking to his disciples, and then he brings the kid, and then he talks about in verse 6, he says, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble. And so this is an interchurch conversation, right? Everybody good with that? So we're not talking about some bad people outside. I'm talking about you people. You people who say that you follow me, say that you love me, say that you are members of my kingdom, and I am the king. I want you to deal with your life and the lives of other people like this. We're not going to get into it today, but after our verses that we cover, he gets into the famous church discipline passages. You know, if your brother offends you, do this, etc. We're not going to get into it. We'll get into it next time. But anyway, he's talking about that. And so when he's saying, as you guys have mentioned, when your hand or foot causes you to stumble or your eye, deal with it. Cut it out. Don't let that sin fester in you and in the rest of the body, as is so easy to do. We just don't deal with it. Okay? in verse 10. So remember, he's in verses 1 through 6, he has brought this little child up into the middle of the people. He just said some stuff about cutting stuff out. In verse 10, he comes back to talk about the kid, right? This is a kid sandwich, if you will. Right? It's all the same point. It's a happy meal. Yeah, you get a toy. And so Jesus says, see that you do not despise one of these little ones, for I say to you that their angels in heaven continually see the face of my Father who is in heaven. What do you make of that in this context? What is Jesus saying, and why does he say it here? What is he teaching us as believers, as followers? What is he teaching these guys here?
He's telling us not to be proud in our faith, like how far we've come from, you know, from maybe when we started. Like, these are new believers, I guess. The little ones are is a new believer, perhaps.
Maybe, yeah.
And so don't despise them. Like people talk about Kanye West or something, like, oh, he's not doing it right, or, you know, I don't know. Maybe for him.
Yeah.
I was thinking of discipleship. It seems like one of the things that we need to do is disciple the youth in the faith and help them along as we were helped along. So it's this cycle of humility, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay, now I do agree that there's a sense in which this could be talking about new believers. But what did Jesus tell the disciples to do when they were talking about the rank in the kingdom?
Be humble, not child yourself.
Go back to the start. Yeah. Go back to the start. There's no difference between you and them.
Mm-hmm. So treat them no differently.
Yeah. So one of these little ones who believe in me, they're a believer just like you. They're members of the kingdom. What's the point about cutting your hand and foot and plucking your eye and then it relates to the kingdom? And then what does he mean by despise? Now, that's a weird word, right? We don't.
Yeah.
It sounds harsh and hard, but what's he saying? Do I have your Greek definition on there? The Greek is somewhat helpful here. Do I have it on your notes?
I'll say that. The other versions say despise, but NLT says do not look down on.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it doesn't mean quite the despise that I'm thinking it does.
What verse are you in?
Treat them unkindly.
Okay, in verse 10. The Greek word is kataphroneo. It means to look down on someone or something with contempt or aversion, with implication that one considers the object of little value. To look down on, despise, scorn, treat with contempt. Does that help?
Yeah.
In this context? Help, tell me what you're thinking in this context. Do you remember? I'll give you the example again. I've used it before. Imagine you're there. Transport yourself in your mind to that circle of people talking. You have the disciples here, and then Jesus probably standing in front of them or sitting in front of them, and he calls a little child up. The little child comes up. And what am I doing here? What do I have to offer these men?
Mm-hmm. What do I achieve?
Yeah. That's not even entering. Like, he knows,
right?
I've achieved nothing. And so the whole point that the kid is here, the one thing that is attractive and important for Jesus' teaching about that kid is what? You said it before.
Humility.
Yeah. And humility is understanding that if you have been converted, it has been done to you. Everything about your salvation is of God. That's true. You have done nothing to offer anybody anything. You have nothing to offer God. Now, God is God with or without you. You're not building up God. You're not empowering God. You're not doing anything. God is God. And so understanding that you have no value to bring or no benefit to bring to God in the kingdom, that doesn't mean that you're not working and stuff like that. We're talking about salvation. Okay, we have responsibilities. We're supposed to do stuff in the kingdom. But at salvation, it was not based on your merit. Okay? And so you bring no value or merit to your salvation. That's the whole reason the kid is there. Remember the definition that I just read about despise? The thing that is important about the child is that he has no value. He brings no value to the group. He's not there because he's valuable. He's there because he's humble. He realizes he has nothing to offer. Despising the child is us looking at the child and treating him as if he has nothing to offer. It's different, right? Okay, so I struggle with this. I'm an introvert anyway. And so I have to pick and choose. I have to get up to talk to people and go out of my way. But I'm tempted to spend more time with the people that I get enjoyment out of, that maybe can give, I can earn something from them or something. I get paid to talk to them. But for the believer, whether a new believer or an old believer, I wouldn't say that I despise them. But do I treat them the same as those that I think can bring me some value? Even if it's spiritual value. I can learn from you and learn how to follow Jesus better because I see the gifts of God in you. Okay, that's great. And we should do that. But for those who just suck the time and the energy out of me, and they really don't offer anything to me, I kind of despise them. I mean, I wouldn't say that. Don't tell them that. But that's how I treat them. Do you do that? Don't say it out loud. You don't have to. This is me being honest. But Jesus tells me, don't do that. Don't do that. Humble yourself and realize you don't bring anything of value to the kingdom. God didn't despise you. I am here because I'm not despising you. Right? Because at the whole start of this conversation, Jesus is the example. He did not pay taxes. He could have, I mean, he did pay taxes. He didn't have to, being the Son of God. And so Jesus himself is the standard by which everyone else in the kingdom is judged. None of us measure up. And so if we're members of the kingdom, it is only because of his mercy and his grace. Right? So don't despise someone as if you have earned your position in the kingdom. They don't bring anything to me. Oh, really? That's what you want to, go there? Okay. So that's hard. So what makes the child good for this illustration? Humility. The child knows he has nothing to offer these men. And what makes the child susceptible to being despised is that he has nothing to offer these men. That's hard. To me, anyway. Like, wow. It's a gut check. Because, and Jesus says this, is important. For I say to you that their angels in heaven continually see the face of my Father who is in heaven. This is probably where the idea of guardian angels comes out, but that's, it doesn't say guardian angels in the text. It just says they're angels. So however God has organized his angels, they report to him on the affairs of men, if you will. And so God is always aware, even without the angels, God is always aware about each person who believes in him, their situation, okay? Anybody's translation have verse 11 not in there or bracketed?
Mine's not in there.
Okay, this is fine. Don't panic. In Matthew 18, verse 11, is not in the oldest manuscripts. When, like, the King James was translated, they had Greek manuscripts that were dated further away from the time that they were written. Newer translations have Greek manuscripts that were written closer to the time that these were written. And so probably what they say is that the scribes, as they were writing this out, just added that in to help with the transition between this section and that. It's actually in Luke chapter 19, verse 10, which is a very similar situation, so that's probably how they did that. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't, you know, anything like that. But it continues, it does link the ideas, which to me, the idea is linked even without that verse. Mm-hmm. It says, the angels in heaven continue to see the face of my Father who is in heaven. In other words, God is aware of every single thing about every believer. Okay? Verse 12, what do you think then? This is Jesus. When he's talking about the importance of not despising these little ones, what do you think? If any man has 100 sheep and one of them has gone astray, does not he leave the 99 on the mountains and go and search for the one that is straying? If it turns out he finds it, truly I say to you, he rejoices over it more than over the 99 which have not gone astray. So it is not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones perish. Jesus is using an example that they're very familiar with. They have 100 sheep. One of them goes astray. The person goes and looks for them. when the person goes and looks for them, they rejoice, they have joy over it, they found it. It doesn't mean that they don't like the 99. They love the 99. The 99 are at some risk because I just left them, but they're relatively safe. But I want to find this one who is at risk indeed. This one going off by itself is really in need. So he goes and finds that one. The overall point is that the shepherd has a different kind of joy in finding the one that strayed. Like, have you ever lost a penny and you have 100 pennies and you really love all the pennies? I'm looking for that penny and I find it. Like, oh, yay. It's not that you want to lose the 99, right? You want to keep the 99. You want all the pennies. And that's the point of this. The shepherd wants all the sheep, not just some of them. Every single one. He wants to keep all of them. So the one that goes away, he's going to find it. It's his sheep. And think about what Christ at this point was doing and at our point has done to purchase, redeem 100 sheep. What does it cost Christ at this point in our time? What did Christ pay to redeem all of the sheep?
His life.
His life. The condescension, we talk about the Advent season, Christmas season, being humbled and brought into his creation, growing and living, growing in grace, being mocked, ridiculed, teaching people like us who are kind of hard to teach, being crucified and raised from the dead. It cost Christ his flesh and blood, and he was to be humble. He was humble in doing it. He didn't have to do that. And so why would we think that he would let just one of them slide away? It's not going to happen. And so what's the point in this? 14, it's not the will of your Father who is in heaven that one of these little ones perish. And so as we're doing church together, live with that in mind. Understand that it is God who has converted you, and that as you're growing in faith and spending time growing the Word, and we often become self-focused on these things like that, others are doing the same thing, and they're just as valuable to God as you are. We all got here the same way, and we're all going to the same place. And it's only by God's grace and mercy. Good?
Mm-hmm.
Questions, comments?
So does that kind of, that sentence right there, that you wish that none would perish, does that kind of contradict Calvinist thoughts, especially hyper-Calvinist, that I think all are chosen, it's just some that just reject the gift?
Is that what the text says?
No, it doesn't. I was having a conversation earlier this week about hyper-Calvinism.
No,
and,
look at verse 6. It'll help you out a little bit. What these is he talking about?
The ones who believe in me.
Believers.
Yeah.
Ones who receive the gift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just had an argument with my father about Calvinism, because he doesn't believe in Calvinism, really. Mm-hmm. Because he told me that if hyper-Calvinism was true, then why evangelize?
Mm-hmm. Hyper-Calvinism is not true.
Yeah, and so I agree with him on that. But kind of going back towards just regular Calvinism, that people are chosen before time.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Lord chose everybody to come into his kingdom. It's us as the sheep that reject it. Say, I don't want that yet.
You're saying that's what you believe, or that's what your dad believes?
Well, no, it was just kind of like what we were discussing. And so I was going to see if I could bring this verse to him, because I brought this up, that God doesn't want anyone to perish. But that means there's going to be some that perish.
Well, no. Jesus specifies, if it's verse 6, one of these little ones who believe in me, and then Jesus specifies again in verse 14, it's not the will of your heaven that any one of these little ones perish.
Oh, okay. The chosen ones perish. Okay.
Correct. I'm sorry if I missed this, but you said that everybody is Jesus' sheep. You don't have to comment on that, but there are some in the Gospel of John. I think it's chapter 10. He points out that, John chapter 10, verse 26. Okay, yeah, verses 22 through 27 would be helpful there. Jesus teaches about being a sheep or not being a sheep. Mm-hmm. And so the essence is not everybody is a sheep. I know we wouldn't like. I'll read it, though. John 10, it says, "At that time the Feast of Dedication took place at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple in the portico of Solomon. The Jews then gathered around him, and they were saying to him, 'How long will you keep us in suspense? If you are the Christ, tell us plainly.'" The essence of salvation is that we believe Jesus is the Christ and all that that means. And we could talk about that later if you want. They don't believe that. Unbelievers don't believe that. Okay? So we're talking about salvation here. Is Jesus the Christ? Yep. And everything that that means. Is Jesus the Christ? I don't know. Or no. And everything that that means. Jesus answered them, "I told you, and you do not believe. The works that I do in my Father's name, these testify of me. But you do not believe." Why not? "Because you are not my sheep." You're not of my sheep. So the reason they don't believe is because they're not sheep. My sheep, because here's what my sheep do. My sheep hear my voice. I know them, and they follow me. And I give them eternal life, and they will never perish. See the perishing about the sheep? And no one will snatch them out of my hand. My Father who has given them to me is greater than all, and no one is able to snatch them out of my Father's hand. I and my Father are one. So in that, it's clear that not everybody is a sheep. Okay? But even talking about in future tense, before someone is saved, they're still referred to as sheep by Jesus. Mm-hmm. Because earlier in that chapter, verses 14 through 16, and this is all I'll read and we'll quit unless we have more comments. But Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd, and I know my own, and my own know me. Even as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and lay down my life for whom?" For the sheep. Not the non-sheep that he just talked to this other guy. This other guy, he said, "You're not my sheep. I'm laying down my life for the sheep." And then he says, "I have other sheep, which are not of this fold," which is specifically Israel people. "I must bring them in also, and they will hear my voice, and they will become one flock with one shepherd." There's not one shepherd for Jews and one for Gentiles. It's just me. I am the Lord of all. "For this reason, the Father loves me, and I lay down my life so that I may take it up again." So anyway, this is the point where he's talking about like Paul's ministry, being a light to the Gentiles. And like us, we benefit from that right there, being his other sheep, and Jesus taking the effort to shepherd people like us on this side of the world who hear the gospel in our own language. So we are believers because of the work Jesus has done. It's nothing we have earned or all that. So does that make sense?
Yeah, the point of this passage is not Calvinism. The point is humility inside of the church.
Exactly.
And so trying to prove a point with a different theological concept out of this passage is always going to be difficult and potentially problematic.
I agree. It just, that verse popped up and I used it against him, and I thought I might as well ask while it's on my brain.
No, I think it's consistent. I'm more dogmatic on these kind of things. Because it does matter about how God saves. And that's what Calvinism is, basically. It's a description of how God saves. Does he do it all? Or is there a combination? Thomas Aquinas and Catholicism believe that it was a group effort by God and man in salvation. Monergistic means just God does it. And that's what Calvinism is. So, but Jesus does use how God saves to promote humility. When he says,
right,
"Unless you are converted," it's a passive act. He uses the passive verb. "Unless you are converted, you won't even enter the kingdom of heaven." Okay? So that's the arresting thought for the disciples to hear that. And then their humility in living the Christian life is based on that fact. I'm only here because God has done it. I haven't earned my way here. So yeah, I agree, this doesn't, our main passage doesn't like explode Calvinism. That's not the point. Mm-hmm. And call it whatever you want, but how God saves is the point.
Yeah, does he halfway save everybody and then we choose, or does he wholly save a certain group of people?
Right.
One or the other.
Right. And Jesus' point here is God wholly saves, and he wholly saves them all. Every person that is a part of the kingdom of God is saved the same way, wholly by God. And so treat one another with that in mind. Mm-hmm. The lesser ones and the greater ones, they're all saved wholly by God. So let that dictate how you treat one another in the church. That is the point.
Right.
So I don't want to put something in there that's not there, but that is there. And it's good for a person who doesn't believe in Calvinism, it's going to be hard for them to see that. They're not going to see that. But I think if we keep our words limited to what Jesus says and not insert additional thoughts and words in that, just let Jesus teach us, unless you are converted, one of these little ones, keep all that there, and then just trust God will teach people the way he wants to teach them. So, but the main point of our passage is, check yourself before you wreck yourself.